This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 13th of October 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Just for the record, though, are you saying that what you said on that bus 11 years ago, that you did not actually kiss women without consent or grope women without consent?
I have great respect for women.
Have you ever done those things?
Women have respect for me. And I will tell you, no, I have not.
Donald Trump says no, he doesn't do that. But at least three women have today said otherwise. Plus, mourning begins in Thailand after the death of the world's longest reigning monarch. And here in Britain, is the country suffering from a severe case of Brexit distraction? Also...
On Paradise Island, there are only women. Because of this pure environment, we are able to develop our minds and our physical skills, unhampered by masculine destructiveness.
How useful might bulletproof bracelets be on the global diplomacy stage? We might be set to find out as the UN appoints a new special ambassador, Wonder Woman. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are, it says here, the Emmy Award-winning journalist, Jeffrey Kaufman.
Do you have a problem with that?
I don't even know
where it is anymore. Okay.
Jeffrey Kaufman is here. And we're also joined by Stephen DL, writer and broadcaster and Russia analyst. Stephen and Jeffrey, welcome to you both. We're going to begin in Thailand, where the world's longest running reigning monarch, has passed away at the age of 88. King Bhumibol served as his country's head of state for 70 years and was widely seen as a stabilising figure in a nation often plagued with political unrest and more than a few coups. And Jeffrey Kaufman, he has passed away at a time where Thailand is in a stage of political unrest. There's been, we're now, you know, some period into a military government, and there is a lot of angst within the country.
So this is where pundits with little grey hair have to sort of put their honesty cap on and say, you're testing my global knowledge really beyond its reach. I have been to Thailand twice, once in the 80s and once more recently. And yes, but I feel totally uncomfortable pretending that I can talk about this with any sobriety or context. So I'm going to just throw this one right across. I do have, by the way, some fascinating facts, quite seriously, about this. Okay. So what's really interesting is he is the longest reigning monarch. He succeeded his brother in 1946, who was 9 years old, who died mysteriously. The assumption was that there was some sort of assassination that happened, and that, in fact, Thailand's monarchy, which dates back many, many centuries, was absolute until 1932. So it obviously comes from a long, long line of leaders. But let's throw it across for some more insightful analysis.
Well, unfortunately, Jeffrey, I've been to Thailand only half the number of times you've been. I'm not a Thailand specialist, that's by any means. But it is, it struck me, the first thing that struck me was, well, what does happen next? Because he's sort of floated above the political sea, because there have been coups and military revolts and so on. And as you say, we have a military government now. And what was interesting to see was the pictures of the crowds distraught. It reminded me rather, if I can throw in a Russian angle, it reminded me rather of the tales of when Stalin died in 1953, and people were weeping on the streets and thinking that was the end of everything. And there are quotations coming out of people saying, "Oh, I wish I'd done more for him." Well, what more can you do?
The interesting thing, Stephen, isn't it? In that we're in a situation now where he was respected and in many cases loved by many, many people across a country which has been extremely divided in recent years.
I think that is the point.
And the Crown Prince, right, who is supposedly to be taking over, is certainly not those things.
And if you look at in 1973, when the pro-democracy demonstrators were fired at, he intervened on their behalf. So he has played more than the role of a figurehead in a country unlike the UK, where we're sitting, where the monarchy has become a figurehead and to some an inspiration. There he has played a much more active role in sustaining values, political values. So you can understand why there is a specific affection.
But then, yeah, so what next? So that's the, you know, that is the worry, surely. You know, in a country which has shown political turmoil in recent years, without that stabilizing figure at the top, what's going to happen?
And we will be discussing that in far greater detail on the Monocle Daily later at 2200. So do stay tuned for that. Let's move on now to the situation in Syria. And particularly, Jeffrey, I want to look at what's happened over the last 24 hours with the British Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, who has in some ways taken a harder line than the British government has before. He's talked about the possibility of military action inside Syria. But what he's also done is he has sort of taken more of a pot shot than perhaps many people would have expected at Russia, suggesting perhaps that people protest outside the Russian embassy. Comments which haven't gone down very well in Moscow, have they?
Well, this is the problem both with Boris and with Russia. You know, Russia is clearly the provocateur here. Russia is enjoying dangling Syria at the end of a string, and they don't. There seems to be a complete sort of cavalier view towards the human toll of this. John Kerry's utter exasperation with Russia's approach has led to this essentially abandonment of hope. You know, the failure of the ceasefire, the sense that there's just no one to negotiate with. And the problem in diplomacy is that when you speak truth, sometimes it doesn't help. And sometimes perhaps it does, no doubt. But Boris Johnson, as we all know, has exceedingly loose lips, and that doesn't necessarily advance his cause. And the fact is, there is no solution for Syria without Russia. And so, as much as he may be right, putting Russia on an even more defensive posture is not going to help us resolve this. He's absolutely right that this is unacceptable, that this is just horrific, and that, you know, it is just appalling to think that our lives go on with normalcy, knowing that this country of, what, 24 million people is disintegrating, that a quarter of its people are now refugees, and that one of its biggest cities has essentially been destroyed.
But it was a stupid thing to do, to come out in Parliament. And I got the impression, seeing the way he said it, that it was one of his knee-jerk reactions. And this is why he's a loose cannon. He's, you know, he could be dangerous in certain circumstances, Boris Johnson, he seemed to come out and just sort of say, oh, go and protest outside the British embassy. He seemed to be doing it more to have a go at the Stop the War coalition.
Well, exactly. What struck me about this was, this is what happens when a political columnist suddenly becomes foreign secretary. Because this would be, you know, a very funny aside and quite biting aside in a political column about how Stop the War Coalition, which is a sort of a far-left group here in the UK, will protest against the West, but won't protest against stopping wars which involve Russia. But when you're foreign secretary...
Absolutely. And also, you know, the West is trying to maintain the moral high ground. There's a very interesting parallel, actually, going back to 1956, at the time of the Suez Crisis. The Russians did organise demonstrations outside the British Embassy in Moscow. And Sir William Hayter, who was the ambassador at the time, he writes it in his memoirs, that there were these crowds. They had very carefully prepared banners and they were shouting and chanting, and the embassy was being very disturbed in their work. And he went out and he said to this policeman who was standing there, he said, now, you know, come on, how much longer is this going on? And the policeman looked at his watch and said, oh, about another 15 minutes. So it genuinely was organised.
You know, when Boris Johnson was appointed to this position by Theresa May, the foreign secretary role, a lot of commentators and I think a lot of citizens wondered what she was, what drug she was taking, what she'd been drinking. They thought this was just insane for this man who is known for inappropriate comments and ill-considered remarks to be put in the ultimate role of diplomat. I think there is the argument that I've always believed is most persuasive about her strategy is that, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, that Boris is such a powerhouse and he had been so successful in the Leave campaign that to leave him out of the cabinet was asking for trouble. What she's done is she's given him just enough rope to potentially hang himself. And I think what you're seeing is that he's starting to put it around his neck. And I know.
But to what damage to the UK why he does that?
Absolutely.
It's one thing if he's like education secretary and no one outside of the country, you know, here's the joke. But
Steve, let's be clear. This is a man who campaigned to leave Europe, and as a resident and taxpayer in this country, I think that is much more damage than anything he's already done. His damage, thank you. Mm. But I think that. Just watch this channel. See where he goes. If this continues, Theresa May made a quite funny comment actually during the party conference last week about people are asking a number of questions this weekend. What was it she said? And will Boris Johnson be able to keep his mouth shut or be able to keep out of trouble? A week later, here he is. So in a few more incidents like that, and a few more extreme ones, and she'll have good cause to dump him and say, "Hey, Boris, we tried." And I wouldn't be surprised if that's where we are a year from now.
Stephen Deal, that sounds like a risky strategy when it comes to foreign policy. These comments in particular, how have they gone down in Moscow?
Like the proverbial lead balloon. At first, the Russians almost laughed it off. And then this morning, they've been coming out and saying, actually, this is not funny. This is not the way diplomacy is carried on. And as I say, it seems to me that he's lost an element, at least, of the moral high ground of the West, saying, look, we're accusing the Russia of bombing the aid convoy, of bombing civilians in Aleppo, add Ukraine and what they're doing there and so on, and suddenly it's reduced to the level of a school playground or just a bad joke. I agree with Jeffrey. I mean, I remember when he was appointed, and I thought, is she just giving him enough rope to hang himself? But I agree with you too, Steve. I mean, education, please, anything. But foreign secretary, it really does seem, and it's seeming now even more bizarre.
I want to turn the focus onto the situation in Syria, which, Jeffrey, as you talked about before, is becoming even more hellish by the day. And what's striking is that when it comes to options of what to do next, while there might be many people who say we cannot stand by and let this happen, the practical options are quite limited, aren't they?
Oh, there's what practical options? I mean, the problem is who are the good guys? Who do you support? How do you align yourself with a bunch of militias that are, in many ways, as vicious and as ruthless as the Assad government. I mean, this is the problem. There are no good guys to say, well, we'll send arms to these guys. And the problem is that, we have this history in this region, this very recent history of boots on the ground not costing a lot of human lives, enormous resources. I'm talking about, of course, the invasion of Iraq, and not having, in the end, a successful outcome. And so there's a great deal of legitimate humility about the ability to invade a country, plant the seeds of democracy, as George Bush wished, and walk away and say all will be good. We know that's just not a scenario. It's why Libya, when I was there in 2011, why NATO decided to do this kind of clinical bombing campaign to keep Gaddafi back, because there was no appetite for boots on the ground, and there was an awareness that the country wouldn't necessarily be pacified if there were. So the problem is, what would you do?
And who would you support, as you say? I mean, it's because also what we've seen in the last 10, 15 years in Britain is that there is now huge support for the armed forces. The armed forces, which during the Troubles in Northern Ireland weren't allowed to be prominent. You weren't allowed to, soldiers weren't allowed to go on the street in their uniform, for example. Now you see them, and people will go up to them, they'll shake their hand, they think, yeah, these are our boys, they've done a great job. But they've done a great job because they were put into such a dreadful situation in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think that if you then suggested that these guys who've done a great job, that either to them or to the British public, oh, well, okay, send them into Syria to do a military job, you wouldn't have support for that.
It's not going to happen. It isn't. I really think it's going to have to happen on the diplomatic front. And ultimately, Russia is going to have to agree to lead it, because Russia is the one that
But then this is the point, Stephen, this is what I want to get your view on. America's problem here right now is that they are not prepared to do anything extra. They're not prepared to take military action for many of the reasons that you've just outlined there. Whereas Russia is trying to shape this and is prepared to shape this conflict by using force and has no problem doing that whatsoever. So I guess there are two questions here. One is, how can the West persuade Russia not to? And the other is, will Russia get to a point where they'll say, OK, we're happy with how the situation is now, now let's sit down and talk?
I think the second one is more likely. I mean, but apparently Kerry and Lavrov may well be meeting again this weekend. I mean, they have actually, the Americans having said we're not having nothing to do with the Russians, there is a report saying that actually they are going to meet again.
Remember that in the remnants of the Soviet Empire, Syria remains a living outpost. It is the one naval base that the Russians have facing the Mediterranean is in Syria. There is real value in the Russian self-image in keeping a finger in Syria. And so Syria is not as important, obviously, geopolitically for Europe, for the United States, as it is for Russia. So Russia really has to be the leader in this. And it's very difficult to know how to navigate with Putin at the helm.
And it's done two things for Russia as well. It's shown the Russian people that actually Russia does count on the world stage. You know, a few years ago, everyone was ignoring Russia and people were going through still this trying to come to terms with the loss of the superpower status of the Soviet Union. This continued, it's maybe 25 years ago now, but it continued for an awfully long time. Now, it's something that Putin was determined to do when he became president in 2000 was actually make Russia great again. And as far as the Russian people are concerned, he has done that. It also, the second part of it, though, for him is that at a time when his country's economy is fast going down, where living standards are falling, where Russia is not favoured by many on the world stage, he can turn around and say, look, they're all out to get us, you see, and they're all out, they complain about us in Syria, but they're not doing anything. We're actually the good guys. We're trying to help out. We're trying to help the situation.
And what a devastating indictment that this man, in the name of sustaining power and aggregating power, is prepared to destroy an entire country, allow, 4 million, 6 million people to be displaced and countless hundreds of thousands to be killed in the name of shoring up a fading superpower. I think you're probably right, but it's just, it's numbing to try to assimilate.
I agree.
What sort of blowback do you think there could be against Russia? Because, as we've seen, at every stage in history, if you take military action in another country, there is likely to be some sort of response in some way.
I think one of the big questions is how secure is Putin? We all assume that it's Putin is at the top. I think around him, he's forever watching his back. Apart from anything else, that's the way he was trained. That's the way he was brought up. I mean, he's KGB and. They don't trust anyone and they believe that the world is based on conspiracy. He doesn't know and understand the word compromise. So I think he is perhaps not as secure in his position as it may look from abroad. But who would take over? The real problem there is that it's not just Putin. It's the KGB that has control of that country, and the KGB does not give up its power easily.
Okay, we'll pause there. When we return, we'll be talking about Donald Trump, possibly Brexit, definitely Wonder Woman. You're listening to Midori House.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page, large-format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, Jeffrey Kaufman and Stephen DL. I want to talk about Donald Trump now because we have to every now and then. We heard during the debate last weekend, he denied that he'd ever actually sexually assaulted anyone. He said he didn't do that. He was just talking about it. And yet, Jeffrey Kaufman, over the past couple of days, there have been a number of stories including one today in the New York Times, with two very different cases of women who are claiming they've been groped and assaulted by Donald Trump, and in other newspapers and on other TV programs as well.
So should we be surprised? I mean, I think this is anyone who's followed him, watched him, would think, yeah. I mean, this is Donald Trump. You know, Hillary Clinton's right. This is the real Donald Trump. And this is what America, the best America, can put forward from one of its two old line political parties as a candidate to run the country. And it's just absolutely appalling. And I think what's even more appalling is how many people continue to stick by him.
Absolutely, including women.
Well, including some women who, you know, the hate for Hillary, much of it founded on unfounded, and this kind of validation of his extreme anarchic values.
It's interesting. We just heard Michelle Obama speaking in New Hampshire. And she makes the point, she says, if Trump is elected, we're telling our sons it's okay to humiliate women.
She's right.
They are,
absolutely. That's what that insanely offensive video from, what was it, Access Hollywood, that we heard a week ago Friday, or last Friday, the time flies. It was utter validation of the worst instincts of anyone. But let's put this in context. You know, as much as we are horrified, and it is shocking how many people are still supporting him, all of the polls, we are potentially heading for a Hillary Clinton landslide, despite the animus towards her. You know, if you for listeners who want to know where I get my information, there are two places that give you a really good analytical view. And the New York Times runs a statistical site called The Upshot. And as of this moment, they give Hillary Clinton an 89% chance of winning. The other one is a former New York Times analyst who now runs something called 538.com, Nate Silver, and that's now owned by ESPN. And they give Hillary Clinton an 86.9, essentially 87% chance of winning. I mean, we are very much on the cusp of a landslide. It's when you're pontificating as we are around this table, you're always reluctant to say anything without qualifying it.
Now, my concern, Stephen DL, aside from the fact that, you know, I'm always just nervous, you know, ahead of polls, is what happens afterwards. So in the last few hours, we've been hearing from Donald Trump. He's again been talking about his fears of a rigged election, about election might be stolen. He urged an entirely white crowd today to go to certain polling stations in Pennsylvania and check to see who was voting. This is the sort of thing that gets then very, very worrying.
Yeah, and he's, you know, if Jeffrey is right, these polls are right, if he does lose, even by, you know, by a landslide, he is not going to go quietly. And also what this has done, I think it's not only shown in America, it's something we're seeing in Europe too, but there is the divisions in society. This has really highlighted them. And the fact that you can get... you know, be it women supporting Trump because they hate Hillary, be it rich against poor, black against white. I mean, you know, America is deeply divided at the moment, and we're seeing there is a trend here that I find very worrying. You know, we're seeing right wing parties in Europe gaining greater support. You know, we've seen Britain saying it's going to leave the EU, and that there was a very interesting quotation. One of the things that Theresa May said at the Conservative Party conference about, she poo pooed the idea of people who consider themselves international citizens of the world. And there is a comparison, and I don't have the reference to hand just at the moment, but there's a comparison with something that Adolf Hitler said, very similar in the early 1930s, that these people who don't respect their nation, who think of themselves as international, then they've got it coming to them. It's quite chilling to see the comparison of the two.
There was something similar in the USSR as well about rootless cosmopolitans.
It's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, when the world was reasonably stable from my perspective, and living in Canada as a teenager and university student, you kind of thought that when you were reading about demagogues, that they were something of the past, whether it was Joe McCarthy in the U.S. or
Stalin,
Stalin or, you know, or Mussolini. And it seemed like some sort of obscure chapter of history that thankfully we've moved beyond. But I think, and I know you would share this, Stephen, that it's odious to compare anybody to Hitler. But it is true that we are now observing how a demagogue operates and how a brilliant demagogue, I don't think he's a brilliant man, but he's a brilliant demagogue, can mobilize people to—
Trump, you're talking
to,
about
yeah,
Trump.
Yeah, to invalidate really evil thoughts. And that's what he's doing.
It's interesting, again, just looking at what he's just been saying right now. He's talking about Hillary Clinton operating in secret, quote, in order to enrich these global financial powers. It talks about how the levers of power are, in fact, controlled by a small band of global interests rigging the system. I mean, the thing I'm grateful for is that Hillary Clinton isn't Jewish. Because this is...
Yeah, no, it's veiled. There's veiled anti-Semitism,
I mean,
in that, for sure.
This is astonishing, this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about Trump's base, and I think this is one of the things that would be interesting to monitor afterwards, is how the evangelists, the hard right Christians in the U.S. continue to stick with him, which seems to me to be utterly irreconcilable with the values of Christianity. To stand by a man who treats women this way, who is so utterly avaricious, who is so utterly misogynist and contemptuous of inclusiveness and tolerance, who racial profiles and who spews hate, and say that it's because he reflects my Christian values, I think it exposes just what that core of evangelists, and I don't want to paint every evangelist that way, but those people who stand by him really have to look in the mirror and say, what Bible actually are you reading?
Absolutely. What do I believe in? What do I really believe in?
Okay. We're going to move on, finally, today. Now, playing a functional role with the United Nations naturally requires a set of skills, strong negotiation, an understanding of international customs, and possibly a magic truth-telling lasso. Yes, as strange as it sounds, the UN's latest special ambassador caught many by surprise. Wonder Woman, yes, the comic book character, has been made an honorary ambassador in an effort to appeal to young women and girls. I must say, Stephen DL, as interesting as this idea might be, it's slightly unfortunate that it comes on the same day that Antonio Guterres has been formally appointed as the new UN Secretary General, since throughout this whole process of trying to find a new UN Secretary General, everyone's saying, we must have a woman this time.
Yeah, it does really sound like a poor joke. And knowing that there would be just a group of guys around the table and we wouldn't have a woman, I just bounced this story off my daughter, who's in her mid-20s. I said, what do you make of this? And she replied with one word. She said, boobs. She said, she's got large breasts. And she said, she's just a comic book character who's there for the geeks who
for the Donald Trumps.
For the Donald Trumps. But I mean, it also is ironic that it comes at that time as well. I just think maybe I'm trying to be kind, and, you know, maybe someone's thinking that this powerful all-action woman is something that women should look up to. But please, I mean, there are so many women actually around the world who you could look up to, real women who do fantastic jobs. It just seems to be misguided at best, or a sick joke at worst.
And also, Jeffrey, it feels as if it's slightly sort of corporate as well, that this is this linked to the fact that there's going to be a Wonder Woman film next year.
I agree with everything you've said. I think, just to be give you a counter perspective, you know, as a foreign correspondent with American television, one of the things that you discover is that there is very little interest in the hardship of refugees, of people going hungry and living in horrible circumstance in Africa. And it frankly makes you very cynical when you see your bosses say, Angelina Jolie is going for UNHCR to wherever. We're going to follow her. We've got an exclusive. That's the way it works. And the problem is that if you don't have Angelina Jolie with those refugees, you don't get an audience. People don't want to watch. And it becomes this vicious circle. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, why I'm pleased not to be reporting that kind of stuff. It is what people want. That being said, Angelina Jolie is a real person.
She's a real person, absolutely.
Whereas Wonder Woman is a parody. She's a Barbie doll with a cape.
Yeah,
and that is deeply offensive.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman, Stephen DL, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. We've got music next, and it's The Urbanist at 1900. That's with Tom Edwards today. And of course, don't forget to tune in to The Monocle Daily at 2200 London time, 1700. No. 1900 even. 1700 in New York. That's it. Never mind. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.